Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and an update on one of yesterday's crazies as well. Jim, let's start with the good martini. And as we said during the transition and in the early stages of the Trump administration, he's got a pretty good cabinet that he's put together. And one of the names that struck a little people as odd when he first nominated her, specifically for the position he nominated her for, was Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, to be ambassador to the United Nations. But I think throughout certainly the right side of the political spectrum, people have been very, very happy with her performance, the strength of her statements on a variety of issues as it's pertained to her work at the UN. And her work on Wednesday was no different. She was speaking at the UN and condemning, of course, North Korea's latest saber rattling, the launch successfully, unfortunately, of the intercontinental ballistic missile on July 3rd. And she obviously says it's time for the international community to actually do something, not just talk about do something, but actually do something to make North Korea toe the line. And she said there's a lot of different options we have out there. Obviously, we have a pretty good military and we could use that if we have to, but we don't really want to. And she said another key area is trade. And here's what she had to say about that.
We have other methods of addressing those who threaten us and of addressing those who supply the threats. We have great capabilities in the area of trade. President Trump has spoken repeatedly about this. I spoke with him at length about it this morning. There are countries that are allowing, even encouraging, trade with North Korea in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Such countries would also like to continue their trade arrangements with the United States. That's not going to happen. Our attitude on trade changes when countries do not take international security threats seriously.
And so, Jim, when you listen to that, the initial instinct, of course, is, well, she's talking about China. Good for her. China's the one that's allowing North Korea to get away with all that. They're the ones that are bankrolling them. Others say, well, she didn't actually say China in that statement, but she did later.
Much of the burden of enforcing UN sanctions rests with China. 90% of trade with North Korea is from China. We will work with China. We will work with any and every country that believes in peace. But we will not repeat the inadequate approaches of the past that have brought us to this dark day.
Jim, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. There's a lot of different ideas out there about how to get China to take North Korea seriously and to actually keep them in line. So we'll see exactly what the Trump administration has in mind in this situation if they, in fact, go down that road. But Nikki Haley's ability to articulate a clear position and a forceful one, very, very strong.
You know, Greg, there are times where you want the high-minded, artistic, even esoteric, you know, stirring language. And then there are sometimes you just want to hear, that's not going to happen. It doesn't get much clearer than this. And it's not incendiary. It's not angry. But it is direct. And I think that's very much what the moment calls for. We saw some indications that China was attempting to apply a little bit of pressure to North Korea earlier in the year, canceling flights, various things like that. But apparently the latest indication is that actually the trade between China and North Korea increased slightly over the last quarter, which is kind of the opposite of what you'd like to see, particularly if the Chinese are telling us that they're attempting to put pressure on North Korea. As this, you know, as we see more missile tests, as we see what appears to be a semi-functioning or potentially functioning intercontinental ballistic missile, that could eventually strike U.S. territories, and you see increasing nuclear tests. In the long run, we have four options, and three of them are really bad. The first one is just live with a nuclear-armed North Korea that can strike the U.S., and I think you can only imagine the kinds of concessions and what the that sphere of Asia is going to look like if North Korea is unrestrained and there's no effective check on them. We can have a military conflict now before we're certain that they can strike us. We can imagine the enormous devastation that they could wreak on Seoul, South Korea, and the rest of South Korea, and conceivably even Japan. We could have a conflict later when they do have nuclear weapons and an ICBM that can strike the United States. And that's the really bad scenario, which we want to avoid. So the only scenario that is not really bad is one in which China, and to a lesser extent Russia, and these other countries that have kind of even, you know, given the North Korean regime a long leash, recognize that unless one of those other, unless they want to see one of those other three options, and in two of them, there are waves of North Korean refugees who will be flowing into China with great desperation and all kind of social upheaval that that would bring. It conceivably could make the, you know, the refugees from Syria look like, you know, small potatoes. Unless China wants to deal with a scenario like that, they really need to lean on these guys. And we will see what happens. I don't think you can say the Trump administration is being vague or half-hearted about this. I think they're being very clear about it. And there's hopefully it will work because, as I said, options one through three are worse. And I think that Nikki Haley is doing about as good a job as anybody can hope for up at the UN.
Yes. The bar scene from Star Wars, as people like to call it in terms of international diplomacy. So good work, Nikki Haley, and let's hope China gets the message sooner rather than later. Jim, let's move on to the bad martini now. And I'm guessing you're kind of like me in that you have news alerts that pop up on your phone when breaking news happens. And that happens fairly frequently, unfortunately, nowadays. And most of it's usually not great news. That's what happened last night. Phone dings. You look at it, and the first two words are Steve Scalise. And you instantly think, oh, he's being released from the hospital or he's been upgraded. And sadly, no, that's neither of those is the case. He's back in the intensive care unit, apparently downgraded from a fair to serious condition. And it appears that infections now are a cause of concern. He's obviously been through several different surgeries now as a result of the bullet that pierced his hip and then hit several internal organs. Back on June 14th, when the gunman, of course, opened fire at the congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia. And Jim, this is bad, obviously, in a number of ways. Obviously, the news we got last night that Scalise has taken a little bit of a turn for the worse is not good news. But also, interestingly, is how quickly the media forgot about this story. On the 14th, when it happened, it was wall to wall. The next day was the congressional baseball game itself, and it was wall to wall again. And pretty much by the time you went into that weekend and certainly came out the other side, whether it was Trump tweets or whatever the news happened to be that replaced Steve Scalise and this shooting in the headlines, that story got further and further away. And honestly, if you had asked me yesterday if Steve Scalise was still in the hospital, I don't know that I could have told you because there's basically been no coverage of it for a number of weeks now. And that strikes me as bizarre and disappointing in addition to obviously the bad news we got last night.
I think your take is right, Greg, that it seems like after they played the congressional softball game, the media lost interest in this. And periodically you get updates on how Scalise is doing. Obviously, our thoughts and prayers are with him to make sure that he pulls through this. You never like to see infections in the hospital. Obviously, it's not, you know, the worst case scenario, but a reminder that until he is healed and he's out of the hospital, he's, you know, not completely out of the woods there. You're right. It's worth looking back to the Tucson shooting and the contrast there. And when Gabby Giffords was shot, there was a major national conversation that I felt like it went on for weeks and weeks. Maybe it didn't, but certainly for like a 2-week span. It was not just about the shooter, who, as we all know now, was a paranoid schizophrenic who believed that Grammar was a government conspiracy, who really had no connection to the broader political debates going on at the time. But that didn't stop the likes of Paul Krugman and other folks insisting, and in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times editorial board insisting that Tea Party rhetoric had somehow driven the gunman to commit his terrible crime. In this case, the idea of the political, overheated political rhetoric driving the shooter, it seems like an easier case to draw now. Now, this has been a recurring discussion in our politics over the last couple of weeks. Was Trump's tweeted video about him punching somebody with a CNN logo on his face, was that inciting violence? We had another police officer who was shot yesterday in New York City and killed, a mother of twins, who, you know, was that spurred by anti-police rhetoric? We have this, you know, annoyingly consistent inconsistency in which we, you know, many people like to believe that the, you know, heated rhetoric that they don't agree with, well, that's dangerous. That's the sort of thing that could set off some nut job. So you really shouldn't say it. In fact, we should rebuke those who make those overheated comments. But if you see incendiary rhetoric on your side, you know, they're just blowing off steam. They're just, that's protected by the First Amendment. Who are you to run around, you know, trying to restrict political speech? Greg, I don't know about you. I could live happily in either world. I could live in a world where everything is, fair game. where the First Amendment protections are absolute, and that we live in a political culture where anybody can say anything. That in some ways, you could say that is what the internet is. You know, people say terrible things all the time, and as long as we apply that consistently, that everything is fair game, I'm fine with that. Or I could live and very happily live in a world with a more polite, respectful tone. You and I generally don't scream at each other here on Three Martini Lunch until the Jets play the Bears. And, you know, I would be very happily living in one where everyone treated each other in a more respectful tone, less name calling, less incendiary. It did not take long after the Alexandria shooting for the likes of Bernie Sanders, who the shooter had volunteered for, to start saying that, you know, thousands of Americans will be killed if the Republican health care bill becomes law. If you really believe those literal words and you believe the congressional Republicans were trying to kill thousands of people, well, then all of a sudden the shooter's actions don't seem so crazy. Now, do they? Right now, you might say, oh, this is just people being like Alan Grayson. Remember when he said the Republican plan for sick people was to die quickly and things like that? Look, I don't want to run around telling people they can't say things. On the other hand, whatever our standard is, I just want it applied consistently. I think it was, you know, Hillary Clinton who said the Republican bill was going to start killing people. It did not. I was among those who said, look, it's not Bernie Sanders' fault that this nut job decided to start shooting at Republican congressmen. But then within one day, the New York Times was insisting that Republicans caused the Tucson shooting when they did not. And then within a couple of days, Democrats were right back. Nobody felt the need to hold back at all. So if look, you know, the next time, God forbid, something like this happens, I think you'll start hearing a lot more arguments from voices on the right saying, hey, you know what? Voices on the left are inherently dangerous. There are a lot of nut jobs on their side. You saw the guy who started stabbing somebody in Portland, Oregon, not too long ago. There, you know, look, and I don't want Americans having to watch what they say on the thought that, oh my goodness, this phrase might be the one that sets off some nut job, because we can't determine what sets off nut jobs because they're nut jobs. But it seems like there is this glaring double standard, not only in terms of what rhetoric do we want to police and what rhetoric do we want to rebuke, but honestly, how much politically motivated violence, and I think you can dispute that the Alexandria shooting was politically motivated violence, no matter what Johnson & Johnson at the FBI might say, Greg. that in these circumstances, we – look, I want one consistent position. And I would like if you – once at the very least, when one of your volunteers goes out and shoots people, I think you should spend a couple of weeks being nice to others. I think you should be a little more careful about the kind of heated rhetoric you deploy in your debates. There's got to be a – all you want to say, Bernie Sanders, is that the Republican bill is a bad bill. Fine. Go out and say that. Don't accuse your opponents of wanting to murder people. But apparently that's too much to ask. So here we are. Hopefully Steve Scalise continues to make a full recovery, but the way the country has handled it and the way the media has responded to that shooting is not encouraging in the slightest.
Yeah, the media's treatment of Sanders is interesting, too, especially given the incendiary comments you just mentioned that he made about the health care bill. If somebody who was a strong supporter of a Republican had done what Hodgkinson did, and then that Republican, you know, accused a Democratic piece of legislation of going to kill tens of thousands or millions or however many people, you can bet that would have gotten a little more attention. But if we talked about double standards, we'd never leave. So, Jim, let's move on to our third martini now. And when you hear about the people that Donald Trump is disenfranchising and leaving behind, it's usually women and minorities and immigrants and that sort of thing. But when it comes to the people who actually show up to protest, at least in Washington, D.C., that narrative tends to fall apart a little bit. The Washington Post did a poll, and I think they're a little bit surprised by what they found here. This was written by Paul Schwartzman and Emily Guskin. One out of every three Washingtonians has marched in protest against President Trump or his policies at least once since January, making the District of Columbia the capital of national dissent, a new Washington Post poll finds. But a clear racial divide exists among those who have attended the demonstration since Trump took office, starting with the Women's March on Washington the day after his inauguration and continuing through the winter and spring with marches against the president's policies on climate change, healthcare, immigration, and a host of other issues. According to the Post poll, 53% of white residents participated in a march or demonstration in opposition to Trump's policies since the start of the year, compared with 16% of African Americans and 36% of Hispanics and those of other racial and ethnic groups. The overwhelmingly African-American residents of Wards 7 and 8, that's the east side of town, are the city's least likely to protest Trump, with only 12% saying they had. By contrast, 54% of residents in overwhelmingly white wards 1 and 3 in Northwest D.C. say they have protested the president. So then they shift gears when they get that stat. Yet whether they rally outside the U.S. Capitol or remain at home, a majority of all Washingtonians, 54%, believe Trump has changed the city at least some or a lot. Jim, it turns out the people who are all up in arms are the people who are really well off. Ward 3 is kind of your hip Adams Morgan Columbia Heights area, so that's a lot of young people, so they tend to vote Democratic, particularly in the urban areas. And Ward 1 is northwest of Georgetown. That's kind of your old money Tony area up along the Potomac River there. So not exactly the downtrodden showing up in the streets this time.
You know, Greg, I went to one of those anti-Trump protests they had way up in Ward 3. Right outside the line of mansions, and they pulled up in their Rolls Royces, and they got out of their Rolls Royces and said, "We can't stand Trump. Pardon me, do you have any Grey Poupon?" And then they held it up and said, "Trump simply isn't cutting the mustard. I don't like the cut of his jib, you see." Yeah, I mean, when you see the sentence, "High-income residents are among the most likely Trump protesters this year," all of a sudden the phrase "drain the swamp" takes on a new meaning. This is the swamp saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, we've got a very good deal here. Stop messing it up for us." I also was kind of struck by the hyperbole. They quote a Sarah Runnenbaum. It says a white healthcare researcher who lives on Capitol Hill. I believe she means a healthcare researcher who lives in Capitol Hill who happens to be white. not that she researches white healthcare as opposed to healthcare for other groups. But her quote is, "Given the ups and downs of the first 5 months, I'm surprised that we're not dead yet." You must be pretty pleased then, right? Better than you expected. There you go. Trump exceeding expectations of liberal D.C. residents. If your standard was nuclear holocaust within the first 6 months, look, I think you owe the president an apology. We've barely had missiles launching and not a single nuclear yet. So if you lower that bar enough, things are going just fine. I'm kind of struck by, you know, when they say, you know, he really has changed the life in the city, Greg. Maybe you go to the city more than I do. Is it mostly traffic?
Yes.
like the monuments are all still there. You walk around, like, what, you know, did restaurants close or something? You know, there's the new hotel down by, like, what, how is life, unless you are part of the Obama administration, or now you're working for a Republican cabinet member who you didn't like, or you were hoping to get one of those Hillary Clinton appointment jobs, which among this crowd is pretty good chances of that. It's been 6 months. I don't know about you, Greg. I don't see those huge changes. So no. I think, you know, it's the changes are in their mind. And but there you go. This is a fascinating poll. And then I fully expect you will see it in Trump reelection materials come 2020.
I think you might. A little bit further down in that article, they're scratching their heads why there weren't more black protesters. And they talked to a couple of black people in the city, and these are the answers they got. Mark Woodard, a black hospital technician who lives in Kingman Park, said he has not felt compelled to protest because his life has not changed much under the new administration, which you just pointed out. Quote, "I'm kind of waiting to see. He hasn't made an impact yet. I'm able to go to my job. My benefits are fine. He's not doing anything to affect me, so I'm not going to support any protests." And this might be my favorite. Justina Jackson, 28, a black assistant pastry chef in Brooklyn who voted for Hillary Clinton, said that she is accustomed to being disappointed in government, no matter which party is in the White House, and that Trump is no different. Justina, that's exactly the right perspective. Life will be a lot less stressful if you just assume the government will let you down.
There you go. And, you know, it's the healing power of pessimism. The other point I'm going to make, you know, just floating this out there for all of these frustrated Trump foes who are wondering, you know, why are only 16% of D.C. residents with an income under $50,000 a year attending a protest march against Trump? Crazy thought. I'm just going to put it out there. Maybe they're working. Maybe they have jobs. Maybe they have families to take care of. Maybe they have other things they'd like to do with their lives than attend a protest. So, I was going to, you know, just put that out there. Contemplate that. And, maybe you'll be hoping, if Trump's policies really are terrible and you know, destroy jobs, then people have more free time for the protests. So it's good news for you guys.
Quick update on yesterday's second crazy martini, you know, where we found Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on the atoll out there in the Pacific in the custody of the Japanese. Well, Jim, this might have petered out after less than 24 hours. After waiting 80 years to solve this, I guess we're going to have to wait a little bit longer, perhaps. This is from the Daily Mail. An investigator who researched the photo for Mail Online firmly believed initially that the figures on the end of the jetty on the island in the Pacific Marshall Islands showed Miss Earhart sitting down with her back to the camera, while Fred Noonan was pictured standing. But when he established that the picture was, among others, contained in an envelope that clearly identified them as being taken after 1940, at the very least 3 years after Miss Earhart disappeared on an attempt to circumnavigate the world, his enthusiasm waned. The 1940-plus date is probably the most disheartening of all, he told Mail Online, pointing out other discrepancies, among them the body shapes of the figures that are now claimed in the new documentary as being those of Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan. So, Jim, this is going to be kind of an anticlimactic special, I guess, on Sunday, but good luck, History Channel.
I look forward to Emily Latella and her... Never mind. Just one other observation. Yeah, first of all, you should always listen to the Three Martini Lunch podcast. We were skeptical yesterday. Still no word on my alternate speculation that the photo actually represented Bigfoot. That is still a possibility out there. One other point to just to add to kind of a closing note, Greg. You may notice that we have a fine listenership and the numbers are very good, but you never know what you're going to do that's going to blow up and go viral. Yesterday, I did a zoom in closer and closer upon this photo that allegedly depicts Amelia Earhart. And using my extraordinary Photoshop skills of basically cutting and pasting, I put in a tiny version black and white picture of Chris Christie sitting on the beach. That has now been retweeted more than 1,000 times. So you never know. Never mind all the fine, dedicated work, all the morning jolt writing, the articles, corner posts, all that kind of stuff. No. It's the silly Photoshop that ends up blowing and be the most influential thing I do all week. So... there you go, Three Martini Lunch listeners. There you go.
You got to cater to the 3-second attention span of the public nowadays, I guess. But fortunately, the attention span of our listenership and readership is as strong as ever. So, Jim, good work. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.